Yes, you have come to the right place. This is The Conversation. I'm Michael Shaw. Good to have you here. Thanks for listening. That is Galina Valle on flamenco. And now, shortly, we will be talking to Iva Georgieva. Say that 10 times fast. Iva has a very intense and fascinating biographical story. So you got to get past the first 3 minutes, though, to hear it. So stick around. Couple quick things before we get to that conversation. One is, it is now heading towards almost summer, and you may have seen the Made in LA show at the Hammer and also at Barnstall. And if you would like to learn more about a few of those artists, you can listen to their conversations here by going to the Conversation artistpodcast.podomatic.com. There you will find Zach Harris, Vishal Jogdeo, and Analia Saban, all in conversation with me. You can go to like the second or third page of that archive and find those conversations. You can also support this show by donating on that homepage. You can also support in spirit by becoming a fan on Facebook by finding The Conversation podcast there and follow on Twitter. And you can perhaps bring angels along to support the show. Or if you are one, feel free to get in touch. Okay, so I think that's about it. Now let's go talk to Iva Georgieva right now. Thank you very much again for listening, and I will talk to you soon.
We really are up on a hill, aren't we? Yeah. It's like there's not that much.
No, like you could sit here and see coyotes.
Yeah.
Like at this hour, we probably see coyotes.
Does it drive your dogs crazy?
Yeah. But they're mostly inside, so they don't even
know. Is the little one, what's the little one's name?
Rossi.
Is he like a recent rescue or?
Oh, no. He's just like perpetually in need. Yeah.
And why does he bite?
He doesn't like men.
Wow. He's a ladies man.
he's a one ladies man.
Oh,
it's
just
me.
So he doesn't like your son either.
No, he's very protective, likes Roscoe. I mean, like likes Nevin very much, but
yeah.
He doesn't. I mean, he wants Matt to like him, but he doesn't really care that much. I think he understands that Matt needs to like him like well enough for him to like stay living in the house.
Right.
But he only loves me.
So I'm here at Iva Georgieva's husband's recording studio at the top of a hill in Echo Park, and we were actually at your studio up until about 20 minutes ago, but there was something going on next door, so we decided to climb for quieter pastures. But something I think that we can try to sort of recreate briefly is the way that your work has gone from more sort of representation or landscapey to more about these layers of surfaces and now to sculpture that you just started at the beginning of this year. And why don't you see if you can sort of trail back to what you were saying when you were talking about the way that, well, here's what it was. You were saying when you were talking about your sculpture that you were starting with your painting to say this goes around this, you kind of visualize things as going around and behind and so on. And so literally, why not try it in the sculpture?
Right. Well, I guess our conversation focused quite a bit on, you know, why the sculptures and how they function in the studio. And what I was trying to express to you is that it's really not any different. It's more a measure of you know, actual distance between things, because in painting there's always one layer sitting on top of another layer, and on a microscopic level there's actually quite a bit of space. You know, there's quite a bit going on. It's just we have you know, see it as a surface on which something happens, and that thing that happens is illusion of space, and we rarely think about the actual physical space that, you know, exists on that surface and the surface itself. So there was always something that, you know, I kept thinking about and playing around with, and at one point I start cutting into the surface and backing it up with other material in the back, and then I was making constructions using paper and building these drawings that were made out of these different layers of mulberry paper and muslin and linen and so on, and still kind of thinking about where the painting actually takes place. Is it on the surface, behind the surface, it is back of the painting, you know, like start to like think about like old paintings, like, you know, the spider webs and all the like shit that accumulates, or even, you know, the kind of magic that unfolds when you open one of those old masters catalogs, and there's like small x-ray pictures that show what the earlier layers were of a particular painting that you know, you know, and yet, like, these x-rays reveal that there was many other things that happened, like, many other worlds that took place. And so all of this thinking went, you know, into an kind of exploration of this question. And so, you know, the sculptures are just literally this kind of almost dumb, like, gesture, like, well, let me just make that space a little bit bigger so I can really, like, you know, not just get my brush behind something or glue a piece of fabric on top of another layer, but actually physically be there where there's a piece of wood and my hand can, like, you know, swing behind and tie something down and so on and so forth. And so this, like, need to get to that actual, you know, physical engagement that has always been so fascinating to me about painting, but now really doing it, like really physically, you know, being inside of them. That's why that corner piece is one that, you know, the body of the viewer can actually squeeze between these elements and stand inside of the painting, you know, inside of that structure.
When you, let's go back, say, 5, 10, maybe even 10 years, let's call it 7.5, make it somewhere in the middle. I'm guessing that it wasn't really even on the table, the idea that at some point you would make sculptures, and then it just, over time, it came to the point where it was necessary?
Well, I've always liked sculptures, for example. I've always liked hanging out with sculptures, and I like looking at sculpture, and I've...
Well, but what happens, though, when the question comes up in your head, maybe I should be making sculptures, what did you say to yourself?
Well, I'm too busy painting.
Okay.
So 7 years ago, I had, you know, these large canvases and my acrylic paint and these sign painting brushes, and I was so into, you know, this layering of many, many, many strokes that are done with, you know, kind of car, like, detailing brushes. So very floppy, very long, very thin, but then, you know, building a 10-foot painting with these tiny little brushes over the course of sometimes a couple of months was excruciatingly painful for my arm, but, you know, very interesting as a journey. And then eventually I started to question, you know, what I was doing, what this accumulation of strokes had to do with. And also I just started to become much more aware of the canvas and the stretcher. And I think parallel to that, I started to develop a lot of physical problems, I think maybe as a result of, you know, overworking, but also...
Carpal tunnel syndromes?
Some sort of, like, a range of syndromes from, like, being pissed off and desperate about the invasion of Iraq to, you know, just painting too much. So it was just all these factors layered one on top of the other caused, like, total freak out. And one day in New Orleans, I woke up and I could not move my arm. So
the invasion... Let me just interrupt you. So the invasion of Iraq... cause you to have a lower immune system, and then that was like one of many factors that went into you having all these conditions happen.
Yeah, I had like a physical breakdown. I think most people have like mental breakdowns, and then like my brain is, you know, my mind is too busy doing things, so I just like put it all into like a full-on physical breakdown that, well, nobody can figure out what was.
Before we get to the physical ailments, was there something about that invasion that connected for you to some of your, you know, communist history and whatnot?
Well, no, it's much more complicated than that, and we can get to it. I think the reason I brought up the physical stuff is actually directly related to your earlier question, which is, I think as my body became more and more fucked up, I became more and more kind of aware of my body. I think for up until that point, like, my body was just this thing that, like, would just do everything I wanted it to do. I never had to worry about it. And all of a sudden, it was just debilitatingly painful and mind-altering kind of experience. And I was, this was, you know, in LA, like 2007, I think. I had this, like, kind of, I was living in this loft, and I looked at these two paintings, and I just had this daydream of them making love. It was really weird. And I just got started to think about how, like, why do I want to look at a painting? Why do I like looking at paintings? And there's something about, like, the encounter with a painting that's very similar for me to an encounter with another person, like with another body. So I think that all this thinking all of a sudden of the body in this, like, very experiential way, very personal way, led me to start to pay attention to how, in a way, the canvas very much resembled, like, my body, you know, the skeleton, the stretcher, the surface, and then, like, all the things that I put on that surface. And, you know, there's kind of diaristic aspect to my paintings as well. So I think a lot of it really started to make sense in a way that propelled the work further and further in this line of questioning, you know. So, and the thing is, I'm really slow about stuff. So, like, you know, I had a broken down stretcher that I bandaged at one point, and, you know, literally bandaged it with canvas and drawing.
Is that a sort of a precursor to the fact that you use a lot of torn pieces of muslin and canvas that look
yeah,
like bandages?
And also, I also don't like to throw anything. So I have all my little guys, like, they just, you know, I have a little pile of this, and then eventually that little pile starts to turn into actual, you
right.
know, thing that I use.
Yeah, well, that's
so
good. It's not just sitting there for nothing.
No, eventually. I mean, sometimes it takes 10 years. You know, I still have felt that I've been transporting since, like, my days in Tyler, and that's ridiculous.
Let me make a theory before we get too far away from your body ailments that you had, because I've experienced this been aware of this in other people, and that is that they're so not in their bodies, or so not conscious of their bodies, that they do a lot of things that, to the point where they're doing things that in people who are really cognizant of their bodies would recognize that it's, you know, that it's bad. And so I'm guessing that to some extent you were enough unconscious of a couple or a few different things that were, you know, sort of building up, and then it got to the point where it was a huge cascade of pain.
Right. Yeah. No, I mean, but I think that happens in, you know, in other aspects of your life. You know, things eventually catch up with you. I mean, I mean, back to the Iraq invasion, I think the reason why I was so crazed by it, and it had nothing to do with, like, my past. It was all to do with that present. Like, I was in New Orleans at the mouth of the Mississippi. I felt like it was the umbilical cord of the insanity of this country. And
that's great.
And, you know, I was living in New Orleans, but teaching in Baton Rouge and at LSU, and I would drive every day on this highway and listen to just crazy, crazy, like, Christian radio.
I've heard about people who do that. Why? So you're basically torturing yourself?
Well, I mean, there was nothing else, because the moment
that was
you,
the only thing you could listen to.
Oh yeah, the moment you reach the city limit,
right?
It go, like, NPR disappears into the fuzz
right.
of the swamp.
Yeah,
everything else disappears into the fuzz of the swamp. And I mean, for a while, my husband was making audio tapes with our dog Jana, at the time, and it was like a mixture of music and also conversations between him and the dog, and the dog was a Zoroastrian, and so there was, you know, these kind of philosophical discussions that they'll engage in just to entertain me. So I'll listen to those, but every once in a while I'll be like, let's see what, you know, the crazy people have to say about, you know.
Right.
And I'll be like, oh, the
right.
So it was just the call for wars was so loud and so without any resistance, except for like three kind of scattered anarchists who had like a bookstore in my studio building. It was like five of us who are just like, no, it's a bad idea, you know, like this is horrible. Why is everybody so excited to go to war? So
people in New Orleans were excited?
Don't you remember the whole country was excited? It was
no,
like
that wasn't my experience.
Well, I mean, I don't know. Maybe you were like on the East Coast. Like
I was in LA.
Was like, oh, you're not. Anyways, it seemed being down in New Orleans, it seemed like everybody was excited. Couldn't wait to go to war. So
right.
I started making these drawings of patriots in like kind of ecstatic dances. You know, these like googly eyed, like helmeted, you know, army guys.
Mm-hmm,
you know,
mm-hmm.
And kind of ecstatic. Explosive sort of, you know, throughout the sky. Yeah. Anyways, it was like my way of processing what I was experiencing
as
utter madness. I mean, it was really like the madness of war seemed to be completely crowding anybody's judgment or sense of history or sense of responsibility. And I just felt like I'll drive and I'll look at a minivan like full of, you know, kids and grandmas and be like, you're responsible and you're responsible and you're responsible and you're responsible and everybody's responsible and I'm fucking responsible and I wanna like scream. And it was so overwhelming, like the impending weight of it all. And it was at the same time, like, you know, being getting back to New Orleans and all of a sudden there would be like somebody interviewed on the radio about like shock and awe and like what a great plane that is. Anyways, so it was a very significant realization of the ways in which like these things that seem so abstract, or maybe earlier in my 20s like seem very abstract, like, you know, I'll be politically active here and there but not in any kind of way that made me feel like I was suffocating. And that particular, you know, period was like, you know, it was my own like failure to, you know, stop it. I mean, I think at the time, like if I could have done something dramatic and stopped it, I would have done it, you know, as a person with like
right.
two skinny legs and two like kind of failing arms, I would have done it, you know. Anyways, it's funny, like I recently gave a talk at Nevada in like Las Vegas.
UNLV, huh?
Yeah, and I was talking a little bit about it in relationship to the work, and I realized like these kids were staring at me with these blank faces, and I realized afterwards I was like, of course, they were like 8 years old when that happened, you know? They were like,
so these,
you know,
kids are
playing
undergrads?
Yeah, they were a bunch of undergrads. I mean, you know, some of them probably have some sense of like what we've been involved in for a decade. But for me, it's like it happened yesterday. And I was talking to these students in the same way. And I realized like, oh my God, it would be the same thing as somebody passionately talking about the horrors of the Second World War. Like, yeah, okay. You know, that's happened a long time ago.
Well, since you're in New Orleans, I can't help but get into your story. Now, we were talking before we got on about how you didn't want to put too much emphasis on it because, I don't know, I'm guessing maybe you think people will get so caught up in the drama of that part of it that they'll be distracted from the work or something?
Well, it's actually more, I was, when I said that, I was more worried about the whole, like, you know, immigration, communism, United States. I mean,
No.
Yeah.
No, that wind frame is out the window. So,
okay.
So you're from Bulgaria.
Yes.
And so, what, were you born in the city, the country?
I was born in Sofia,
uh-huh.
Which is very much like LA. It's in the foothills of the mountains. It's smoggy and, you know, but you can...
But there's no ocean.
But you can get out. You can, well, the country is really small, so you can drive to the sea, you
right.
know, in about 7 hours.
Right, right. And what kind of sort of family environment did you have?
Yeah, my mom was a pediatrician. My dad was a he was a engineer and an aircraft engineer, but also he flew on Bulgarian Airlines. So it was very unusual, but I had a lot of. Kind of access to things outside because my dad traveled all the time. He had been everywhere from Cuba to China to
wow.
all over Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And so from a very early age, I was completely fascinated with, you know, places, us, other places than where I was.
Where did he take you?
He took me to Zimbabwe and then to Sri Lanka and to Malta. Never to Western Europe, but I did go to Africa. And so in our house was my parents, you know, they're doctor, engineer, but they've always had like a very personal love of art. So like most of my dad's colleagues will buy gold or silver or whatever, and he will come back with, you know, carvings and wooden masks. So our house was filled with African masks and statues, and we had a tooth of some kind of morsh, and it's like a sea lion, I guess, so, engraved by Eskimos.
Wow.
And I still remember it. Like, I, you know, sometimes I think about, like, okay, what is my connection to drawing? Like, where, how far back does it go? And I realize, well, it's all the stuff that was in my house, you know, my parents, you know, had this, I mean, it was so beautiful the way that the line was done. And then, yeah, so it was, you know, normal Bulgarian family. I mean, yeah.
Well, what was your family's experience in relation to the change of the climate, though? I mean, I know you don't want to get too much into that, but I mean, just because you left at a certain point, so...
Well, I mean, that's the whole tragedy of what happened in that period because, you know, it was a total breakdown of the society. I mean, complete, like, just... I mean, people always think, like, that we came here for a better life. No, we had a really good life there. I mean, comfortable in terms of material comfort... We moved from a comfortable place, a safe place, to inner city Baltimore. It was insane. Like,
can you just briefly?
The contrast.
Can you just briefly describe?
The contrast.
Just no. Just the overview of what kind of, you know, what kind of climate forced you to your parents to make that call.
Right. Well, so in the course of about a year, so I still remember in 1989, I was watching television. We had been hearing from my dad because of the traveling and also from BBC and what's the radio show? Free America, whatever.
Radio Free America?
Yeah. So we'll get it on our radio just a little bit. So we knew about the Berlin Wall, you know, we knew that all this stuff, there was all this... you know, motion, and obviously, you know, Gorbachev's presidency really started to change the Eastern Bloc in a very significant ways. But Bulgaria was always very quiet. You know, we were always just compared to other countries, like Romania, we were actually very materially comfortable, and there was a lot of exchange because we had incredible tourism, and also our leader Todor Živkov was. Somehow had convinced Moscow that we were totally fine. They don't have to worry about us in terms of allegiance. We are totally, fully committed. You know? But in the meantime, you know, a lot of affairs on the side. And but all of a sudden, like, he was deposed. And then, I don't know, really, it's a long story to really kind of get into the intricacies of like how these changes just happen. It just seemed like overnight. Overnight, all of a sudden, I was no longer in school. I would be on the city square surrounding the parliament, demanding the removal of a clause in the constitution that made the Communist Party be kind of the party that can govern in the country. And my mom got really, really involved from, you know, just a pediatrician who loved her kids. And, you know, we had dogs and, you know, cats and parrots and all kinds of animals in our time, you know, our apartment, to all of a sudden being a political leader. And it was like these bearded men who are pro-democracy. It was just the excitement at first was so magnificent, was so amazing. And people really wanted like a change, but in this kind of very idealistic way. You know, it was a revolution. It was beautiful. It was beautiful. And then a year later, we realized that all that energy really kind of facilitated an economic and military shift in terms of who the elite is. So all of a sudden, like, what our efforts did really was to take all this, all that was public property, and all of a sudden, overnight, turn into private property. Where these private property owners came from? So the country was sold off to whatever, other outside interests, and all of a sudden, we walk up to capitalism. And my dad...
Who owned these things? For different entities?
So for example, Bulgarian Airlines was all of a sudden sold for something like, I don't know, $200,000. I mean, this is like a very developed airline, you know, that had super contracts with, you know, places in Africa that no other, like, you know, European airline. I mean, the British will fly to Bulgaria and then fly to Africa, you know, that kind of stuff. And all of a sudden it's sold to some conglomerate of interest behind closed doors. I mean, it's just, that's what happened.
Privatization. So was that the end of your dad's job, or was it so that it was not worth having?
It was just, for my parents, it was totally like a collapse of a sense of any purpose. For my mom, on a totally emotional level. For my dad, it was more the realization of like, oh, okay, I know what's going to happen. It's going to be 15 years of just misery. Absolute misery, corruption, total corruption of the values in the society, because he had seen it in Africa, he's seen it in other places. Like, that switch from like a socialist to a capitalist system is just brutal. That transition is brutal.
Right.
It robs people of, I mean, to survive, you have to really compromise. And for him, he didn't want to do that. He didn't want to put his family through that. So, I mean, we didn't come to America. We just left Bulgaria. We're on our way to Australia, but then in the last moment our plane switched, we were going to Canada, but then there was a snowstorm in DC which grounded the airplane, so we couldn't make it to Buffalo, where this white van with some Macedonians were going to help us across the border. I mean, the whole thing was crazy. And so we ended up in Baltimore because of some 26-year-old boys that I had met the summer before.
So the initial plan, though, we'll get to that in a second, was to go to Australia. Did your parents have a connection there?
No, but it just seemed easier. We had visas. We got visas for Australia. My dad went to Sri Lanka and went to the embassy there and got visas for Australia. So we had visas for them, but for there, but we couldn't use our free airline tickets to go there. So we had to go north because of tourism kind of restrictions. Mm-hmm. So it was Christmas time. So somehow, like, you know, we decided we'll just go to Canada. But everybody was leaving. Like, I'll never forget one of our friends who was my parents' friend, who was a journalist and but much older. I still remember my mom, you know, in tears, handing him the key to our apartment and our car, and he like picked out from his pocket, and it was just like a huge keychain of keys that close friends had given him because he was staying. So it was just tragic. It was just really tragic.
Have you been in touch with him?
No.
Your parents? No.
Mm-mm. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's like endless, the details.
Is it a choice, though, to leave it all in the past and not look back at all?
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's too painful, it's too complicated, and there's just too much in the present that's, you know, I'm emotionally involved with to really, like, kind of dwell too much on that, all that. I mean, it's also, like, you know, after 22 years, like, some of it starts to become a fiction in a way, you know? It's so... I mean, the memories are so intense, and yet I feel like, you know, I've told some of that story to friends, I've told some of that story to my husband, I've told some of that story to, like, you know, somebody random on the airplane, and sometimes, like, you know, I feel like, well, you know, I know it's all true, but it's also so... It's so distant and at the same time so present, and I feel like I do a better job of dealing with all these memories, like, by drawing. I somehow have, like, this deep suspicion of words, even though here I am, like, blabbering away. But there's a certain... I've always felt hesitation with words.
Well, no, I think this is something we sort of tangentially touched on towards the beginning when we were talking about your work, and what you were telling me in the studio briefly was that you don't, it's not like you have a big spiel about your work. It's just kind of like you have these ideas in your head that you're then playing out physically in the work. And so that's, I think that kind of represents the fact that you don't trust the words.
I mean, it's interesting because, like, I don't know, I think life is just full of contradictions, and like, that's one thing that I've always been interested in, is contradictions. Like, I had this theory early on of, like, you know, the fringes, like, you know, you always have to have, like, one foot in, one foot out in order to have perspective, in order to have, like, kind of critical insight into things. Like, you can never feel too comfortable, and so I don't know, I've always chosen, like, this kind of slight outsider look into things. Maybe it's just, like, the existential condition of being an immigrant. Like, I don't fit anywhere, really. I don't fit here, I don't fit in Bulgaria. Like, I mean, it took me 20 years to, you know, be funny in English, and, like, now I go to Bulgaria and, like, I'm not funny in Bulgarian. It's like,
you've gone back?
I've gone back a few times, but...
Oh, so you're not putting it completely behind you.
But, you know, speaking of contradictions, in college, I studied philosophy. I was fully, fully immersed in text. Mm. But it's a different kind of relationship to language. It's it's an investigative kind of relationship to language. And the writing that is associated with that is, you know, it's very specific. Like, I loved writing exegesis, which is, like, you take, like, a paragraph of, I don't know, some bizarre, like, text by Plotinus, and you write, like, 10 pages, like, kind of pulling apart what, you know, these four sentences are about. So that's the kind of interesting language I have. But, you know, a friend of mine was making fun of me for my terse emails. It's like every time I sit down and I write something, I feel like a liar, you know, when it's just like...
That's good to know about those terse emails. So how much English did you have when you left Bulgaria?
Hardly any. I mean, you know, because of my fascination with the world out there, I really wanted to learn languages. So I had a private teacher who taught me English, but I only did that for about a year before I left. So, you know, I knew the first few sentences of "We are the world, we are the children."
Well, did you have to act as sort of the translator for your family when you were first in the States, or how did that work?
Sort of, yeah. I mean, my dad spoke a little bit of English, but I think I was the most... I mean, my brothers were... One was 4 and the other one was 8. And I was 15. So, you know, I just had no choice. Like, and my mom was just crying nonstop for, like, the first year. So I had to, like, take over. You know, I had to just... It's like survival, you know?
Yeah.
Kind of amazing what you can do when you're in that kind of adrenaline of survival. You know, you really have no fear. I kind of miss that time because, like, now I'm just, like, constantly immersed in fear about everything. But back then, like, you know, I was not afraid of anything.
It's only nostalgia, though, because back then... Yeah. Okay, so how long were you in Baltimore, then?
Well, we lived in the city for 2 years, and then my parents moved to Mount Washington, which is a really nice little, more quiet area, predominantly Jewish, lots of trees. I mean, very different from where we first landed, which was basically like, you know, fires and heroin and gunshots all day long. But and then I went to college in Baltimore. I went to Goucher College, and then afterwards I moved to Philadelphia. So, you know, I don't know, 6-7 years, I guess, in Baltimore, and then Philly, and then New Orleans, and then LA. So
That's the short version.
That's the short version.
Well, what made you decide to go to Philadelphia for art school, and then after that, New Orleans?
Well, because I thought I was going to go to philosophy graduate school, and I had gone to some, like, University of Boston, I don't know, something like that, and, like, I was sitting in my dorm room because my friends and I got kicked out of our apartment, and so we had to move to the dorms like the last 2 months of senior year, which was really silly. But I still remember I was sitting there like, what? I'm not going to philosophy school. So I started calling like people and asking them where there's like good art schools. And somebody told me there were art schools in Philadelphia. And I literally drove there the next day. And, you know, it was the end of this year. It was May. And I ended up like just driving to Tyler. And running into this like tall woman there who was a painting professor, and she looked at me sort of like, okay. And I had some snapshots.
So she was taller than you then?
Yeah. Yeah. That's Donna Nelson. And it was amazing. But anyway, so I had some just like, you know, pictures, snapshots of just some stuff that I had made. And she looked at them and sort of said, well, you know, why don't you just move to Philadelphia? It's too late to apply now, but move to Philadelphia, make some paintings, and apply. And so I was like, okay. And so that's what I did. I moved to Philadelphia, got a really horrible job working as a office assistant for an interior designer.
What did your parents think about this move? I mean, because the thing that occurs to me, did you consider getting a second opinion from anybody, or was it
completely? No, I mean, but the thing is, my parents never understood why I was studying philosophy. I mean, they always thought that I should be an artist. It was just my own like struggle with this idea of being an artist, like on the one, you know. I think what happened was like I just felt like, you know, it was too easy. Like, I was getting praise for, you know, how I can draw and how I can, like, make stuff. But I felt like I had I didn't know anything about the world or other things. So that's why when I went to college, I, you know, my first set of classes was economics, biology. I was terrible at economics, but biology, political science, like, everything, like, as far away as possible from art. So I think my parents just always trusted me, and so, yeah, I don't know. I think they question me a lot more now than back then.
So you think that maybe you were not trusting art at the time to some extent?
Well, I just didn't know what that really was. I don't know. I felt like I knew when I was very young, and then I just didn't quite know what it was, and I wanted to do something that I was really challenged by, like language, like writing and reading, and yeah,
right.
Something that I was bad at.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, it was, you know what, it maybe is like you wanted to, the same adrenaline that you got from being this kid in Baltimore defending for your family's survival.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe it was that experience that showed me that there was like a lot in the world that didn't make any sense. I couldn't understand it. And, like, here it was in America, and I had never seen poverty like this. I had never seen like violence like this. There was like, I mean, I saw people with no teeth. Like, I thought that that was not. I mean, people with no arms, like begging on a corner. I mean, I think it was a certain shock to that experience that made me feel like I really needed to know, in order to like make art, I needed to know a lot about other things besides how to draw something. I mean, that seemed like really kind of easy. I mean, I...
So your interior metronome wanted not to just take this sort of art-only route, but to be rounded by these other things.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. And, yeah, I think also maybe it's the... I don't know, like, the way that art functioned in my society, which, you know, we had, like, a social function. It also...
What was its social function?
Well, you know, there was sculptures and paintings, and it was labor. You know, in Bulgaria, painters were paid salaries the way, like, a steel worker would be paid salaries. Mm. Like, there was considered, like, kind of socially important, like, labor, the way that an actor is paid by the National Theater. There was, like, a guild of you know, organization of the you know, painters who... visual artists who were, you know, treated in a similar way. So it seemed like there was, you know, there's kind of recognition of that labor. And when I came to the States, my experience in Baltimore, I mean, yes, I went to the Baltimore School for the Arts, but that seemed like, you know, educational kind of thing. But I didn't really see art anywhere else in that society. It didn't seem to have any place whatsoever. I mean, there was the Walters Art Gallery that I like to cut school and go hang out and, like, look at, you know, sort of followers of Hieronymus Bosch. They had, like, an incredible collection of that. But, mm-hmm. You know, visibly in, like, the day-to-day life, it seemed like completely absent. I mean, completely absent from anywhere from people's experience. I mean, in Bulgaria, people had paintings in their houses. Like, I went to American House. I never saw any, like, art or books or... I mean, it was, you know, so...
That's still a problem.
So that, I think it was just the whole mixture of things that made me, you know, hesitate. And then, you know, later on, I mean, I continued to do it. I never stopped doing it. It was just, like, this other thing, like, my secret life. Like, mm-hmm. I made paintings at night, and I made paintings that you can only see with a flashlight, and I'll do puppet shows for my, like, stoner friends, and, you know, like, I always made stuff. It's just not in this official way. And I think, looking back, I think that that's always been actually important, because I realize there's, like, a confusion sometimes, like, with art, you know, and why people make art. I mean, sometimes you can get really, like, you can forget why you started doing it in the first place. And, like, I realized, for me, I always actually tried to lose any, like, institutional or any kind of reason, and I just made it because I had to, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Then, you know, this kind of external approval for all my questioning. I feel like I always search for that much more, I don't know, I don't want to say pure, but, like, kind of, like, it's necessary. I am that weird person that has to do this.
Mm-hmm.
The way that, like, other people have to, like, masturbate 20 times a day. You know, like, it's just this, like, you can't help it, kind of.
But it's not in that analogy that you're using. It's not as secretive or maybe as dirty feeling after you do it.
You know, I don't know. I went through, like, some at one point, like, when I was in graduate school at Tyler, I went through, like, a kind of a shameful, dirty feeling with art. I mean, you know, it was like, it was during the bombing of Kosovo, and I was, like, sitting in my nice studio with my art friends who only talked about art, and
right.
There I was supposed to make paintings when, like, I felt like some horrible crime was being committed, you know, so...
Art was the poster child, if you will, for privilege.
Yeah, it was about privilege, and I was meeting more and more people who came from privilege and for whom, you know, this thing... So, yeah, it felt very, very privileged, very bourgeois, very...
What was your...
Safe.
once your family moved from that, you know, dangerous part of town to, you know, Mount Washington, did you then have a different relationship to... privilege, middle class, you know what I mean?
Well, we still lived in an apartment building, you know, that was, like, you know, the apartment was the size of, I don't know, most people's, like, kitchens.
Wow.
And, you know, my family's always, since we've lived in this country, always lived in like total fear of like the smallest little thing can happen and like you're on the street. And I think that's the most experience for most people in this country. It just for us was like shocking. I mean, I had this like horrible nightmare slash daytime error, you know, in New Orleans where I realized like, my God, like if there was like a horrible breakdown of society like we experienced in Bulgaria, it would just be utterly horrible. Like, this country is already so violent. I mean, you know, in Bulgaria that happened, but there was never any violence. Like, you know, people had their homes. People had some degree of dignity. Like, here you can lose that dignity so quickly, you know?
What about Katrina? Were you there?
I mean, you know, no, I left 2 months before Katrina because, you know, I had some, like, secret, like, little insight from my drives to Baton Rouge. I was like, if we don't leave, we're going to die. That's what I kept telling
my husband. Wait, 2 months beforehand?
We left 2 months before.
Did you know that a storm was coming then around?
No. I'm not like a prophet or anything like this. It's just like, you know, the place was so rotten and like so beautiful in one ways and so fucked up in every other way. And, you know, the degradation of the environment was so visible to me, even though I was like a, you know, I was just stopping in, like, driving on the highway, and I still was so visible to me. Like, the row of chemical factories, the way that the swamp and the wetlands had turned into, like, an amusement park where you can go see the cypress trees and, like, this one, like, private ranch where you pay $3 to see the cypress trees and the rest of it is gone.
Mm.
So I knew that this was inevitable. Everyone who lived there knows that it's inevitable.
Yeah, I was going to ask you. So you were not alone in this.
No. It just, you know, for most people who grew up in New Orleans and like most
leave.
Of my close friends, like, you know, they can't function anywhere else. I mean, it's a very, very special place.
Right.
But it's a very difficult place for, I fell in love with New Orleans when I was a kid. I was like obsessed with New Orleans. So when I was in college, I always wanted to go and I kept
When were you there when you were a kid?
No, I never was there.
You never were there.
No.
You had this media version of it that you fell in love with.
Don't even, like, it was like a postcard, and I really liked Tennessee Williams, you know? So when I went to college in Baltimore, I finally drove to New Orleans and instantly made friends and kept going back there. And so I had this love relationship with the city
mm-hmm.
and the people who lived there, but mm-hmm. It was all very beautiful, and it was very different when I mean, 2 days after I moved there, I was just like, this is a terrible mistake. This is just the worst mistake I've ever made. I knew it, and I still stayed for 3 years. I mean,
what was the turning point that made you say, oh shit, I can't believe I did this?
It was just a sense that I don't belong.
But I thought that's what drew you there, that you did.
I know, but it's different. It's visiting there, it's all beautiful. When you are actually there and you sit there for actually a minute and you pay attention, you feel the rot, like the history of violence and the poverty and the corruption, and it's just rotten. It's rotten. Like, you know, most places, like, and even in Baltimore, like, the violence still kind of made sense. It was like about drugs, it's about like money. In New Orleans, it's about the heat, you know? It's about like just rage and madness.
Mm-hmm.
It's different. It's a different kind of violence.
Hmm. What was it that made you choose LA then? I know you said it was dry, but there must have been a little bit more than that.
It was basically like, do we move back to the East Coast?
And then you already met with your husband then?
Yeah.
Where did you guys meet?
In Philadelphia.
Okay.
And so it was just a decision, like, you know, I wanted to move to a place that had like an art scene, you know, other than like a small town like New Orleans, which was very supportive, but it was very small. I wanted to go to a real city, back to like a, you know, a bigger city. And LA has mountains, has a way out. So that's how I thought about it.
Right.
It's like I can leave the city. And in having lived in Baltimore, Philadelphia, and visited New York many, many times, you know, I have like really kind of absurdist stories of like trying to go camping and failing to do so because there's no like public land really, unless you go upstate New York. But, you know, you have to be a little bit more like, I don't know.
rich or yeah. a party kind of place.
Yeah, you have to be a little bit like, you know, it's like when you come from like, you know, inner city Baltimore, you have a limited scope of like places where you think you're allowed to go.
Right.
In upstate New York, in my mind, it's still like not a place where I will be allowed to like go.
Wow. So this period in Baltimore really shaped you as much as Bulgaria did in a way, it sounds
like.
Oh,
absolutely. I mean, you know, I came at a very... I was 15. So I have enough to remember and I have enough of an experience in Bulgaria, but it was really... That's where I became like a, you know, an adult. It was in Baltimore.
Right. A young adult.
Yeah.
An
yeah.
adult too soon, perhaps.
Way too soon. It's amazing. Like, yeah. in the 20-year anniversary, my family got together, we're sitting around looking at pictures, and there was a picture that really brought tears to my dad's eyes, because there's a picture of me the night before we left Bulgaria, and there's a picture in the same album, just like a few pages down, kind of in the same posture, but it's a picture of me 2 months after we came to Baltimore, and in one picture I look like a child, and the other one I look like a, you know, a woman in her 30s. I mean, now I think I look more youthful now than in those pictures back then.
You were a hardened youth at that time.
Yeah, well, it's yeah. like brutal, brutal experience.
Well, you know, this is all interesting, I think, momentum for bringing up the fact that I think is, that I wanted to bring up, which is that you came to LA then, and your art career sort of, you know, has had a lot happen in a very short time, you know. I mean, going from, because I think even, well, actually, hasn't it just been the last 3 or 4 years?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So talk about, I mean, we should say that I met you a couple times back in 2009, and I had heard your name before. I'm not sure where, but I know that you gave me and a couple of people that I was with these announcements for this show that was like at Otis, I think. It was like a big drawing show at Otis.
Right.
Yeah, and so, you know, so it was like you were in shows like that, and then, you know, Angles, and then, you know, New York, and now you're going to this residency that people like Ed Ruscha go to in Tampa. You know, it's like that's all happened in 3 years?
Yeah.
Is that how it happens, basically? It happens fast, I guess, when it happens.
Well, I think it happens... Well, it happens when it happens, you know, or it doesn't happen, or it happens for a little bit, and, like, you know, I don't... I try not to think about it too much. I mean, I am driven by fear, you know, so... my close friends are always like, you know, giving me a hard time that I just don't seem to realize that things are going well, and I'm like, well, you know, my whole like life has had to do with like things ending, you know, things are constantly ending, so, you know, and this is one thing I don't want it to end. I want to be able to paint, and I think that's the ultimate kind of drive, is like I need to do this, and more than ever. And so, like, all these things, like, whether it's graphic studio or a show, it's just, like, it gives me the sense of, like, oh, maybe I can do this a little longer. You know, it gives me a little tiny bit of confidence that maybe, like, you know, I'm not going to get caught and, like, you know, thrown in the mines or something. I mean, it's a very weird kind of... thing of, you know, fragility and getting strength from that fragility, and it's
but you're a long way from being complacent, clearly. So right,
yeah, I mean, the thing is, though, you know, when I went to Tyler, it's not a place where you talk about painting, like, you talk endlessly about Agnes Martin or, you know, Fontana, and I think we had like one talk from a professor that was basically like, you know, you have until 35 to do anything or forget about it, like that kind of thing. Or I heard once one of the professors saying, like, you know, there's many art worlds, you have to know what you want out of it. And then one other advice was like, you have to always do what's best for the work. And really, that's the one that's been like the central one, you know, what's best for the studio, for the paintings. drives a lot of my decisions. And the rest of it is, I came out of Tyler with no expectations whatsoever. Like, the first thing you do is, like, you get a job. And so I got a bunch of jobs in Philadelphia and, like, hung out with my friends and made stuff, like, in the kitchen table. I mean, there's no galleries. There's no, you're, like...
Well, now, here's the question, though. Now you're working on your... You're getting to work on your work pretty much all the time, right? Or,
Yeah, recently. I mean, I did teach for a long time as an adjunct. I taught at UCLA for almost the whole time I've been in LA.
How did you get that job, right, when you came to LA?
Well,
was that
No. I mean, it was just like one of those things. Like, sometimes I feel like I get lucky or something. I had sent a painting from New Orleans to Carl Berg. And then Roger Herman, who was the department chair at the time, he's a painter, a faculty, and he just happened to walk into Carl Berg Gallery and, like, saw this painting leaning against the wall in the hallway, asked him what that was, and he was like, oh, this weird girl in New Orleans, but I think she's moving here. And so I was literally packing the U-Haul, and I got a phone call, and actually I had to hang up because I had a termite in my ear, and I had to call this person back, and it was Roger, and he was like, hey.
You had a termite in your ear?
Yeah, well, there was a termite swarm in my studio, so there was termites going in my nose and ears.
Ooh.
So I was like, excuse me, I have to, like,
what did you do?
Well,
what does one do when they have termites?
They might still be
in
there. I have no idea. They might still be
Are
there.
Are they tiny?
They're like, like ants with wings.
They're that big.
But they're,
okay,
like, crawling to you.
Ooh,
you know,
yeah.
It's crazy. So anyways, I called him back, and he was like, well, do you want to, would you like to teach a painting class? I was like, yeah, sure. So, I hadn't even moved to LA, and I had a job, so it was pretty cool.
That's a pretty good way to step into the water.
Yeah. So, I feel like, in some ways, like, LA has been really, really hospitable and gentle towards me, and I had a chance to, like, recover from my physical ailments and, get better over the past, like, I don't know how long it's been now, a while, 8 years, 7 years, something like that. And it's a really good place to make art, I think, because it's such a lonely place. Like, that's what I realized lately. It's a very lonely place.
Yeah. Well, when you were first, I'm just curious about, for the artist listening, going from teaching, and making work to not teaching and making work. I mean, is, for anybody who, who does various kinds of things in addition to the work, what are some things about that transition, or, the pros and cons of either side?
Well, I mean, I miss it. It really, for me, it's not even like, oh, I need my time for my studio. It's just, I have a kid now, and that's very, very time consuming. And when I was pregnant, I got so pissed off the way that people approached me. And, it was like, oh, you're going to have a baby. Oh, great, you're going to start sucking any moment, as an artist. Like, I just got that, impression from all sorts of different people, like, other artists. And, like, it was never even, like, malicious. It was just, like, that's how people look at you when you're a woman and you're pregnant, you're an artist. And so I was, like, really pissed off about that. But, of course, like, I had a baby, and then, like, the art market and the whole, whatever money machine went crashing, so... it was very hard to, like, have a baby, teach at all these different places. I was teaching at Claremont, Fullerton, UCLA. I was juggling so much. I was so exhausted and making, a lot of work and pushing and pushing out of just, like, sheer anger to, like, prove all these fuckers wrong, So
your motivation was spite, wasn't it?
Yes, it was like anger,
Bulgarian
style.
See, Mark Maron talks about that. People will be talking to him, and I'll say, so it's spite, isn't it? And they'll go, yep.
Well, whatever. Like, you have to deal with and accept, like, a range of emotions, you have. But
Well, do you think that's a, I mean, what that brings up for me, what these friends or colleagues were saying to you, I mean, I think it's just representative of the way, how judgmental artists can be, and, you know, and so
yeah.
on.
And judgmental or ungenerous or, like, in a weird way, like, they, you know, sometimes I could feel like, I wish it was a little bit more a place of, the art world was more of a place of, like, camaraderie. Like, I was at some, I got this grant, and, like, we had to go to Idlewild to be educated on how to be, like, better business people. And I was like, wait a second. Like, you know what the problem is? Like, we need a union. And because we're talking about, like, health insurance, and not a single one of the artists there, like, even in a joking way, took what I was saying as, like, a legitimate thing to just, like, toss around for a moment, you know? It was kind of interesting to me, like, how, you know, that seems so far away from anybody's mind. Any kind of, like, you know, us against, you know, like, us as the makers, as the ones who do the work, against, like, whether it's museums, collectors, galleries, like, you know, as a force, like, a united force. I don't know, maybe it's just, like, my, wished that somehow it was more about, like, you know, a collective making. I mean, even though, like, I do collaborate with people and I do make things with other people, and, like, right now I'm working on some, like, video pieces with, like, these friends of mine who are gonna do the sound and, you know, performers, and I always like to sort of step out of the kind of singular experience of mm-hmm. the painter in the painting studio. I really need that. And I think teaching had a similar function for me, like this way of confronting things outside of my own, like, you know, head. But I do wish it was more about, like, kind of collective making of some kind of more, I don't know, a little bit more of a force that comes from a few people rather than, you know, the kind of super fragmented, like, art stars, you know, hierarchies, tiers, people will only talk to you sometimes at openings if you happen to be the most, like, you know, interesting person in terms of what their own interests are.
Yeah.
You know? And then the moment somebody else, like, more important shows up, they, like, completely drop you.
Yeah.
It's, like, amazing. The wandering eyes phenomenon.
I'm sure I will be talking to some of those people soon, actually. So if you have any questions for them, let me know. No, I
yeah.
agree. I mean,
you all are fools.
What's that?
You're all our fools.
a union idea, I don't know. It's more just spreading kindness, you know?
I just think, like, you know, as artists, like, yeah, we should be able to talk about anything. So whenever people, like, completely resist talking about something, I am always suspicious of as to, like, what underlies that unwillingness, you know, to just take up any subject and, like, toss it around as, like, a possibility. Why not, right? When it's met with utter silence, I am, you know, very intrigued by what's behind that.
Do you have
silence.
Anything in mind that you're referring to? Mm-hmm. Do you have anything in mind that you're referring to?
Well, I think it's like a
silence?
Well, it's, you know, sometimes, like, well, looking back, you know, certain conversations seemed, like, you know, very much not welcomed, like anything to do with, you know, politics for a while was, you know, very, very unwelcomed, I felt.
Wow.
Or sometimes even, like, you know, intellectual talk. I feel like there's a real resistance even amongst, like, some of my close friends to engage in, like, you know, anything that remotely seems intellectual. Or sometimes I find, and I fault myself in this as well. Like, there's more of a kind of catty talk than, you know, talk about ideas or issues. Or,
yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
that's kind of the first instinct, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I think that we have plenty of examples in the history of art, but also in the history of humanity of, like, you know, really, like, rich kind of intellectual moments where discussions brought people together and new things were born. I don't know, in like some ways I'm like always, I always think like I have such hatred of humanity in some ways, and then such love of humanity and such hope, you know, for humanity. And I think it comes across in the paintings. You know, there's the yeah, I don't know, like the horror. It's, you know, the sight of like a group of a large group of people, and also like the sense of like, wow, you know, that force, that creative physical and emotional force that all these like human beings are capable of. But that same, you know, crowd is capable of other really horrific things and also absurd things. I'll tell you one quick little anecdote about New Orleans. I picked up some like book that told anecdotes, like, you know, first person anecdotes from, you know, going back over the years, and mm-hmm. one particular one that really stuck with me, actually made a painting about it, was a priest who you know, goes to the city, to New Orleans, and somehow like he manages to gamble away all the parish's money. But he tells, relates a story of they used to fight animals in the French Quarter, and they would fight bulls and tigers. At this particular time, the tiger would not come out of the cage to fight the bull, so the crowd got all pissed off and broke the cage and dragged the tiger out to fight this bull. And you know, that beautifully, you know, kind of plays in my own kind of imagination. So, yeah.
When did you make that painting?
That was the last painting I made in New Orleans.
Yeah. Got it. Well, are you good?
I'm good.
Thank you for talking.
You're welcome.